Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with George Zornick, a Washington-based reporter for The Nation. He has an article at The Nation, Romney's Seven Biggest Debate Lies, and we will fact-check the howlers from last night's debate that came thick and fast from a cynical candidate operating on the assumption that a lie will go around the world before the truth has time to tie its shoelaces. Then, as billions are starting to pour into last-minute attack ads that will carpet-bomb the swing states, we will look into how effective negative ads are with John Geer, the chair of political science at Vanderbilt University and the author of In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns. We will discuss how much presidential debates can alter opinions created from months of negative advertising in a political climate where facts seem to matter less and less. Then finally, we will discuss perhaps the most challenging issue facing the planet that was not mentioned or brought up in last night's debate, global warming. New York Times reporter Andrew Revkin, the creator of the Times' .Earth blog, joins us to discuss what wasn't discussed and critique what was discussed: cheap gas, clean coal, more pipelines, more drilling, and more jobs. Joining us now is George Zornick, a Washington reporter at The Nation. Previously, he worked as a senior reporter blogger for thinkprogress.org and as a researcher for Michael Moore's Sicko and as an associate producer on The Media Project on the Independent Film Channel. He has an article at The Nation, Romney's Seven Biggest Debate Lies. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Zornick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And if you are a fact checker who is following the extraordinary casual relationship that Mitt Romney has with the truth, you've been working overtime. I mean, from day one, going back to the Iowa caucuses, the first commercial he ever made put John McCain's words in Obama's mouth. And he is an amazing liar. And frankly, he's been getting away with it. So how would you rate last night's performance in terms of his overall career as a consummate liar?
Well, I'd say your characterization is pretty accurate, and so last night's performance was pretty consistent with his overall loose relationship with the truth. It was actually kind of a challenge looking at the transcript and trying to pick out only seven lies, because I wanted to get this piece up sometime, you know, within a day of the debate. But there were so many things he said that were inaccurate or not true. But what we tried to do was look at some of the big ones, some of the big questions, the big lies that he's telling on both his tax policy and how many jobs there are in this country and what the the energy record of the Obama administration is and so forth. But I mean, at almost every question, you could at least see, if not an outright lie, you know, at least a kind of gentle shading of the truth.
Well, the one lie that he's been pushing for some time is to pin Obama to the deaths of the U.S. diplomats and the SEALs in Libya. And Obama actually fought back and basically said, you're wrong. And in fact, I did call it a terrorist act the day after in the Rose Garden. And Romney immediately refuted that. And then the president somewhat plaintively calls out to Candy Crowley, you know, because she corrected Romney, but in a very sort of soft and apologetic way, an unobtrusive way, shall I say. And Obama called upon Candy Crowley to repeat it louder, just to let him know that he was wrong. And he still sort of filibustered his way through. Do you think the public got that exchange, that this is, first of all, it's an absurd issue, but secondly, he really is reaching?
Yeah, I mean, it is an absurd and sort of complicated issue. And I think even if people were watching didn't understand what the mechanics of this particular situation in Libya were, they saw something. They saw clearly that Candy Crowley, you know, flagged Mitt Romney for a false statement. And I think it played into the narrative that the Obama campaign has been working to build, I think quite fairly for many months, that Mitt Romney is a guy who will just say anything to look good and get elected. That's a narrative that actually, Mitt Romney's opponents in the GOP primary campaign helped him start building. That was something that, if you watched those Republican debates back at the beginning of this year, which, God, seemed like years and years ago, but you know, you saw again and again people like Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich hitting Romney for just saying things that aren't true or that sound good to get him elected. And so I think, again, even if people didn't understand the mechanics of what exactly was happening in Libya, they, seeing Romney get flagged for an untruth by the moderator was something that will kind of stick in their heads.
So, as you know, obviously, it's I've made it clear that I consider Romney a fatuous salesman who is just a cynical liar of breathtaking hubris. However, I'm in an alternative universe to a lot of people. The swing voters, I was watching after that debate, they had panels of swing voters and undecided, and most of them were going to vote for Romney. So what does that say about the American people? Do you think that the truth matters anymore?
Increasingly less so, I think, as people are just finding their own news outlets to tell them that whatever they think is true is true. You only needed to turn on Fox News after the debate last night to see an example of that. And part of it is just kind of a natural thing that I wouldn't as much blame people for as just Romney taking advantage of very complicated issues. I mean, I think, you know, when he says that his tax plan isn't going to cut taxes on high-income earners, that's a very false thing to say, but it's something that has a very complicated answer to it. You have to look at the across-the-board rate cuts and then the deductions he wants to bring down and how, you know, do a lot of math about who would be affected most. And it's not something easy to rebut, and it's not something that I think the average, say, middle-class American who, you know, goes to work and is watching the debate while they're cooking dinner for the kids, I mean, they just might not have time to really think through that and examine all the information because it is very complicated. And so I think that's something that Romney is just capitalizing on, and he'll just say it because he knows that the truth is too complicated to really fact check.
Yeah, but you would think that there's a simple rebuttal to that canard that Rob Romney's quoting him. The top 5% of taxpayers will continue to pay 60% of the income tax the nation collects. Okay, I see what he's doing here, but the point is that the nation is collecting, what the nation is now collecting from the top 5% is much less than they should be collecting because of the Bush tax cuts, and Romney himself only paid 14%, and he hasn't even revealed most of his tax returns in any case, so he may have in other years paid much less. Isn't that the answer, that in fact, that doesn't even address the issue of tax fairness?
No, it doesn't at all. And one thing Obama might have said is, well, look, you're clearly cutting the rates for top earners, and you say that it won't affect them because you're going to make it up in deductions, but you won't say what those deductions are. So how are we supposed to believe you? And I mean, this is something I think the media has been in, you know, the media can help the average voter who might not have time to sort through this make sense of it. I mean, that's kind of what their job is. And I can only imagine if Obama came out with a plan that said, okay, I'm going to raise all these taxes, but don't worry, I'm going to make up for it with spending cuts, and I'll tell you what those spending cuts are later. I mean, the right wing would go nuts, perhaps justifiably, and the media, I imagine, would just be all over him. But there seems to be, for whatever reason, a kind of a hesitance to get into the weeds of Romney's tax policy and just say, look, what he's saying makes no sense. It only makes sense if you magically trust and believe every claim that he makes that he refuses to back up. So I think there is a failing there.
Again, I'm speaking with George Zornick, who's a Washington reporter at The Nation, previously worked as a senior research blogger for thinkprogress.org, and he has an article at The Nation, Romney's 7 Biggest Debate Lies. So we've talked about the lie, which he repeated several times, about how the top 5% taxpayers will continue to pay 60% of the income tax the nation collects. To obfuscate the fact that he's actually going to cut taxes on the rich who are already enjoying the Bush tax cuts. Let's start with some of the other lies here, and if you just don't mind giving us a brief rebuttal or a little reality here. This is Romney. We have fewer people working today than we had when the president took office.
Right. That's just plainly not true. It was true a couple months ago, or at least as far as we knew, according to the data, it was true. But when the Bureau of Labor Statistics released their estimates last month, that also revised upwards the number of jobs that have been created this year. Obama finally crossed that magic threshold where more jobs had been created in his term rather than had been lost. Now, even if he hadn't crossed that magic barrier, which makes for a good talking point and where Mitt Romney is totally wrong, it's still kind of misleading for Romney to talk about this. Number one, because there's actually been close to 1 million jobs created in the private sector while Obama's been in office, but they've been offset by deep losses in the public sector. And that's something that, you know, unambiguously, if you look at Mitt Romney's policies, he'd like to see continue. He'd like to see less public workers. Beyond that, you know, saying how many jobs were lost versus created during Obama's term is kind of a rough metric for the president, because when he came in, you know, as he's fond of saying, the country was losing 800,000 jobs a month. So in January and February, in particular of 2009, you had just like massive catastrophic job losses. And so to say that Obama should be expected to make up for those in order to have a net job gain is, you know, a pretty tall slope to ask him to walk. But nonetheless, he's walked it. Circling back to the original point, there actually have been, without any debate, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, more people working today than when Obama took office.
So let's move to the question of contraception. This is quoting Romney. I don't believe employers should tell someone whether they could have contraceptive care or not. Every woman in America should have access to contraceptives. That's what he said last night.
Right. I mean, this is one of those things where I think Romney has just given up even trying to shade the truth or say things that are very technically true, but, you know, in a larger sense, false. Because the way he worded it, there are ways to get around this question. But he, as you said, he explicitly said, I don't believe employers should tell someone whether they can have contraceptive care or not. That is exactly, if you read the text of the Blunt Amendment, that is what it is. That's what it does. It says, employers, if you don't want to provide contraceptive coverage to your employees, you don't have to. And had it passed, employers would have been able to deny contraceptive care to their employees. And that's and Mitt Romney unambiguously several times on TV in print supported the Blunt Amendment. So there he's just saying something that is absolutely, completely, fact-checkably false. And I wish Candy Crowley would have jumped in there as well.
And it's worth noting that Roy Blunt is Romney's liaison to the Senate.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt he made a big deal of supporting that policy. When there was, back in March, there was he kind of gave a statement where he sort of, it sounded like he wasn't supporting it, but you couldn't really tell. And they immediately rushed back out and made sure everyone across the country knew, no, we support this amendment. So for him, you know, 6 months later, 7 months later, to get on the stage and say that he doesn't believe that was pretty shocking.
And of course, he went on to talk about, as a matter of fact, oil production is down 14% this year on federal lands. I think that was one of the occasions where I think Obama basically shot that down, even though I think the overall argument that Romney was making, that we need more oil, gas, coal, you name it, we need North American energy independence, and that'll get the price down at the pump, which was the essential framing of the question. It seems that Romney was pandering on that one. And of course, you know, people basically want cheap gas, even though it's not ever going to happen again. Let's turn to the George Zornick, Washington reporter for The Nation. He has an article at The Nation, Romney's Seven Biggest Debate Lies. Let's turn to the one about how he was looking for women in binders. It sounded almost like bondage, but in any case, he said, Romney, and so we took a concerted effort to get out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and I said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women. I was proud of the fact that in Massachusetts we had more women in senior leadership positions than any other state in America. And that was, of course, in answer to a question about the glass ceilings and pay equity for women. What was your give us the facts on that one?
So pretty much everything there is wrong. Number one, this binder did actually exist that everyone's joking about today. This binder, it did exist, but it was put together by a nonpartisan coalition of women's groups who said, look, we need to get more women into the government in Massachusetts. And they started this before he even took office. Beyond that, the guy who led that effort came out today and said, yeah, Mitt Romney never even met with us. Now, it is true that he did hire, he did appoint and hire some women while he was governor. But overall, there was a study done in Massachusetts right after he left that showed that high-level appointed positions in the state actually declined about 28% while he was governor. Beyond that, if you look at Romney's entire record, not just when he was governor of Massachusetts, there were absolutely no female partners at Bain Capital for 20 years throughout the entire 1980s and entire 1990s. Beyond all this just anecdotal stuff about, you know, the women that Romney hired or did not hire, as it were, I mean, in the end, that stuff doesn't even really matter anyway. What matters is the policies he would advocate as president. And there, again, Romney is a guy who opposes the Lilly Ledbetter Fay-Parr Act. He opposes the Paycheck Fairness Act. As soon as he got into office, of governor in Massachusetts. He scrapped the state's affirmative action program. So putting aside this debate about the binders and how many women did he hire, it doesn't really matter anyway. It's very clear that while Romney was trying to paint himself as, you know, a friend of women and someone who wants them to be hired and paid equitably, that's just not what he believes from a policy point of view.
And, Joe Zonik, let's turn to another one of the lies from last night. I want to make sure we keep our Pell Grant program growing.
Right. So this, again, was just kind of a crazy thing for him to say. Romney has never explicitly, as is true on many issues, has never explicitly said exactly what he would do to the Pell Grant program. But his website, if you look on it, has a lot of language that should make people nervous. He says he's going to refocus the federal spending on Pell Grants, and he's going to place the program on a responsible long-term path. Usually when you hear words like that, it's time to reach for your wallet. But he does have a guy in his ticket who has been very specific about what he wants to do to Pell Grants. That's Paul Ryan. And his budget would, without question, axe about 1 million Pell Grants a year from the federal rolls. So when he says he wants to keep the Pell Grant program growing, I'm not sure exactly what he means there.
Well, he's a big booster, Romney is, of the for-profit colleges, which are a complete racket, basically taking money from the federal treasury because of their lobbying, and it's a bipartisan disgrace in Washington that these for-profit college rackets have bought a bunch of lobbyists and Congress people on both sides, and they use federal dollars to advertise and get these kids deeply into student debt. Of course, they get the federal government money for next to nothing and charge it back to the kids at onerous rates. And these are mostly young minorities and a lot of vets. And they end up with worthless degrees and a lifetime of debt. It's an absolutely despicable and cruel process. And Romney has supported it, and he argued for it in the primaries on the stump. And furthermore, his own son, who he set up in a private equity company, is an investor in these for-profit college racketeers.
Yeah, absolutely. His record on higher education through and through, from the for-profit colleges to reducing the federal aid, is terrible. But again, going back to your original point, he doesn't care, and he's not aggressively fact-checked enough on that, because any low-information college student or someone who's approaching college who watched last night would have no idea about any of the things we've just been talking about. They would see Romney saying, I really think I like Pell Grants and I want to grow the program, and they'd think, okay, well, that's good. But it unfortunately bears no resemblance to reality.
Well, let's go to number 7 on your list of Romney's lies from the second presidential debate. We're going to bring that pipeline in from Canada. How in the world the president said no to that pipeline, I will never know. This is about bringing good jobs back to the middle class of America, and that's what I'm going to do.
Right. I mean, one of the biggest lies in Washington, and unfortunately it's been a somewhat bipartisan one, has been that this Keystone Pipeline project will create jobs. The Cornell Global Labor Institute and the State Department itself have both looked at it and said, well, you'll probably create somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 jobs. While the pipeline is being built, there'll be short-term construction jobs, and then they'll go away. So, well, you know, that's certainly good for the people who would be hired, but it's not, you know, 3,000 to 6,000 jobs is not anything that makes any kind of impact on the economy or the overall unemployment rate. And when you're looking at these very severe environmental consequences of building the pipeline, you have to look, is that really worth, you know, 3,000 jobs that last for 6 months? I think most people would say probably not. And an additional way that he's actually been dishonest there is that Obama, and I think he's received a lot of progressive grief over this, but Obama has actually green-lighted the southern port of the pipeline that goes through, you know, the southern United States. So a lot of those jobs that Romney is talking about, half of them or so have been created anyway and are, you know, in effect in some southern states at the moment. So he wasn't totally honest about that either.
Well, George Zonik, I thank you for the job you've done here. Of course, one wonders whether it's futile correcting these lies, given that the barn door's open and the horse is down the paddock. And what's that expression is, the lie goes round the world once before the truth gets a chance to put their pants on or tie their shoelaces or something.
exactly it. Yeah, and I think millions and millions and millions of people saw the debate last night, and would that it were that millions and millions of people read thenation.com every day, but I don't think it's so. So,
well, we all live in hope, and I thank you for joining us, George Zornick.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with George Zornick, who's a Washington reporter at The Nation, previously worked as a senior reporter blogger for thinkprogress.org, and as a researcher for Michael Moore's Sicko, and as an associate producer on The Media Project on the Independent Film Channel. He has an article at The Nation, Romney's Seven Biggest Debate Lies. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and hear a defense of negative campaign ads.
No, I don't want to start a flame in your heart. No, I just want to set the world on fire. Baby, remember what they told you did. Like honesty's annoying most of the time. It's better entertainment.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Geer, who is the Distinguished Professor and Chair of Political Science at Vanderbilt University. His book, In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns, won the 2008 Goldsmith Book Prize from Harvard University. Professor Geer is currently working on a series of projects that look at the news media's coverage of attack advertising and how negativity may help voters make better choices. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Geer.
Well, thanks for having me.
And you're quoted in a recent article in Bloomberg, perhaps having second thoughts here, saying now we now have an excess of negativity in these negative campaigns. So are you revising and extending your remarks, as they say in Congress?
Well, maybe. I don't think of it in those terms, but neither do the members of Congress when they're revising and extending their remarks, I suppose. But I think what's going on here is that I would still defend, you know, attack ads and the information they provide and the role that they provide in kind of democracy. But I do detect a change over the last 20 years that I'm bothered by, as you referred to, calling it excess negativity, that what's unfolded is the journalists and their efforts to cover negative ads and in some sense to vet them and to give the public a full understanding of these ads have given a huge amount of attention to these ads. They don't pay much attention to positive ads. And because of this effort to protect us from negative ads, the ironic twist is that now consultants want to air even more negative ads because those are the only ones that will get on the free media. And so the incentives to run ads have changed, and there's now a greater incentive to create negative ads than there was 25 years ago.
So, but what I find extraordinary, John Geer, in this campaign is that fact-checking has become a cottage industry. It's referred to all the time, whether anybody actually listens to the facts. You know, there's that old expression that the lie goes around the world before the truth ties its shoelaces. So
right.
What do you make of this effort now, not so much in the presidential campaigns to fact-check the debates themselves, but to fact-check the commercials?
Well, I mean, I think the objective, again, about fact-checking commercials is a noble one. I mean, they're trying to vet these ads, but there's a series of problems, I think, with them. Problem number one is that they're bringing attention to the very ads that they're worried about by discussing them again. Second is that the model that oftentimes these fact checks have is that they don't want these ads to be misleading. But the difficulty is that all ads are designed to be misleading and that they're propaganda. They're designed to put the best foot forward of the candidate and the worst foot forward of the opposition. And so to find out that they're misleading is, you know, seems to me to be, of course they are. That's the purpose. And the real twist here is that because the negative ads are the ones that are more likely to have facts, the ones that are more likely to have evidence in them, and the positive ads are vague, general claims, that these fact checks disproportionately pay attention to the negative ads giving even more attention to them. And so I'm not at all convinced that they are, you know, working quite as well. The intention is a good one, but the end result is I'm quite, you know, a little worried about.
So let me try and tie in negative advertising to compare it with presidential debates, given that we just had the second presidential debate, which certainly in terms of Obama's performance was quite different from the first. But my understanding of Romney's tactics were that he took the calculation that nobody much was paying attention, and that in the first presidential debate, he'd have a substantial audience. As it happened, it was over 60 million people,
right.
And that he could introduce himself for the first time to most voters, and therefore repudiate his previous positions. But that seemed to me to have the effect of essentially negating, you know, millions, even perhaps a billion. I don't know how much money the Obama people had spent on framing him negatively, and had been quite successful in doing so. At the end of the day, it would look, at least based upon the evidence of the first debate, that a good debate performance can overcome, you know, millions and millions of dollars of negative advertising.
Well, there's a couple of things there. First, I think this campaign, when we look back on it, isn't going to be the amount of negative ads, which are going to be unprecedented. It isn't going to be the amount of money spent that's unprecedented. It is the fact that all this money was spent with very little payoff. That is, it didn't move many voters. That first debate, I think there is an argument to be made. I mean, we don't have enough data to be sure, but there's an argument to be made, as you just suggested, that Romney was able to undo a lot of the attack ads that the Obama people had aired during the course of the summer. But among the reasons why that was possible was that Barack Obama, in that first debate, didn't hold Romney accountable. He let Romney get away with various claims. And in some sense, Obama needed to keep up the negative tactic of saying, look, you have all these views, you're going to favor the rich, and hammer Romney on that. And he didn't, and he let Romney move to the center unchecked. And so that if you think of that debate could have been much more informative if Obama had pushed back and said, whoa, wait a second, Governor, that isn't right, and had been more engaged. So that debate itself is a kind of a highlights why negativity, so to speak, can be useful, because Obama could have had a chance to inform the public much more, at least based on what he thinks the right views are, than by letting his defense down and letting Romney kind of having an open field.
Well, I was talking yesterday, John Geer. Again, John Geer is the distinguished professor and chair of political science at Vanderbilt University and the author of In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns. I had a political pro on last night who's done a lot of Democratic presidential and Senate campaigns. So he's sort of been in the back room coaching candidates. And we talked about this extraordinary odd democracy that we have here in the United States, given that most of the country doesn't even know there's an election going on, yet up to $6 billion are going to be spent almost all on the swing states. And as you get closer to the elections, the undecided, the swing voters, become the attention of all that money. And at the end of the day, this political pro pointed out the terrible irony that these swing voters, or who are politely referred to as low information voters, are totally disengaged and perhaps not the brightest amongst our population. And yet they are the ones who ultimately decide.
Well, there is a certainly a concern about that. But a lot of those undecideds may not even vote. It may also be true that they're just waiting to the last minute. I am reluctant, as a general rule, to say that, you know, in some sense, your argument is that, you know, we're being governed by the worst, that is, the least informed. And, you know, it's hard to decide what exactly the amount of information a particular voter, you know, should have, or what, you know, low information versus high information. It's clear that the undecideds are different than the people who've decided. But the people who have decided, the partisans, they're not looking at both sides of the information. They're either pro-Romney or pro-Obama, and they're kind of dismissing the other side. So it's more of a mixed story. I mean, this country has, you know, people worry about it every election cycle, and the country continues, even though we're in a recession right now, you know, the country continues to do well, at least as far as its fundamental institutions. And so I'm kind of more of an optimist in general on these kinds of things. But then again, I'm defending negative ads, and so I'm already out there as an odd duck.
Well, I'm sure you would, John Gear, you would defend debates, and surely we need more of them, don't we?
Well, I have to say that these two debates have been pretty informative, and I think they're a good format. I mean, one of the ways to think about presidential campaigns, or really any campaigns, is that, you know, you think of it as a heavyweight fight. And it is to some degree, but for the most part, the candidates stay in their respective corners and then construct images that are caricatures of their opposition and hammer away at that. But a debate's different. You've got to go toe-to-toe. You've got to go into the center of the ring, and you risk the possibility of getting, you know, a knockout punch laid on your chin. But that's why it's so interesting. And there's various points in time where those, you know, they weren't happy with each other, and they were, you know, jockeying for position. And, you know, I think, you know, Romney made a couple of tactical mistakes in the debate, not that it was a disaster, but, you know, Obama probably won overall, but certainly by comparison to the first debate, there was a gap, but it wasn't anything like that first one where Romney clearly did have the equivalent of a knockout.
And my understanding is that, I think you put your finger on it here, John Gear, that these people don't like each other. And my understanding isn't that one of the reasons why Obama had such a lackluster debate was that he simply felt, you know, uncomfortable being in the same room as somebody that he really doesn't have much respect for. And that may have been fatal for him in that debate.
Yeah, it's possible that, you hear these speculations, and, you know, by the time a campaign is at this point in time, given how close it is, usually the combatants aren't buddies.
Right.
And so that's kind of natural. I don't think that McCain and Obama were friends, and Kerry and Bush were not friends, and, you know, that just goes with the territory.
Well, you mentioned Kerry. Now, perhaps the mother of all negative ad campaigns was the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign,
right,
largely orchestrated, I believe, by Karl Rove, who, of course, is still a very powerful player in the Republican Party and making, a singularly important impression on this campaign with the various super PACs that he's organized. Now, that's even become a word in the vernacular, swift boating.
That's right.
So, compare that one to what's followed, because that was in many ways both the nastiest, the sleaziest, and the most successful.
Well, the Swift Boat ad is a great example of my general concern about the process. The Swift Boat ads aired to approximately 1% of the American public. That was all the ad buy was, very small. Yet by September of 2004, near the end of the month, about 80% of Americans knew the term. The reason for that is that the news media covered the Swift Boat ads all the time, especially the cable networks. And so if you go and do a LexisNexis search, which is a search engine that you can do and look at news media coverage, the term Swift Boat got more attention in the 2004 campaign in major media outlets than the term Iraq War. And so the Swift Boat ads were a problem, and they certainly were a sleazy attack. But the reason they worked wasn't because of the ad campaign. It was because of the news media's attention to that ad campaign.
So do you think that Karl Rove, he's going to play a role. We know that. And we know that his super PACs and his 501c4s, which don't have to reveal the donors, are making huge ad buys. And my understanding is, if you look what happened in the most recent election in Wisconsin, towards the very end of that recall election, enormous amounts of money was spent. Not one home was not visited several times. Flyers was stacking up on people's front porches, and the airwaves were just saturated. So are we going to have this last-minute carpet bombing? Obviously in the swing states, but do you expect it?
Well, I expect, yes, I do expect it, but I don't think it's going to make much of a difference at the presidential level. I've been somewhat surprised by how disorganized the super PACs are. I've been somewhat surprised by the quality of the ads, which I don't think are very inspired. And we have people who have very set preferences. I mean, we've talked earlier in our conversation about the small number of undecideds. And it's just going to be hard for these ads to do much moving because there's just not that many people to move. But where I am worried about the super PACs are dumping money like in a Scott Walker recall, but doing it at a lower level so you maybe change a Senate race, so you change a House race. I mean, imagine if all of a sudden some super PAC arises supporting Aiken in Missouri. I mean, that might be able to get, you know, in a close contest, give him a sudden boost that allows him to win that seat despite all his problems. And again, that's a bigger concern because as you go down the ladder of elections, people have less information and they're more susceptible to being, you know, moved by these ads, and that could make a difference. But it's, you know, it's a really brave new world out there since Citizens United, and we just don't fully have a handle on how all it's working. I suspect 2016 they'll be, you know, have learned some lessons, and the super PACs, whatever effects they have in 2012, I bet they're even stronger in 16.
Well, one of the most surreal questions that came up, well, the question wasn't surreal, but the atmosphere felt it, was that question about asking Mitt Romney about George W. Bush. I've never seen anything like it. Our former president is totally toxic.
He is, and it's, and I think that the long run of history, I mean, it's not that he's necessarily going to go down as one of the top five presidents, but I do think there'll be a renaissance of sorts with George W. Bush. And it's interesting because the economy, even today, even 4 years after he left office, or almost 4 years, still a huge hunk of the electorate assigns a responsibility for our economy to him rather than to Obama. And that's pretty unusual. But it was interesting to see that there, you know, Romney certainly referenced Reagan in a positive way, but he tried to distance himself from George W. Bush. And then even Obama twisted it in a way that I thought was interesting, pointing out some of the things that Bush had done that was right that Romney opposed. So it was an interesting exchange.
Well, my understanding is that actually Bush and Obama have quite a friendly relationship.
You know, I do not know any of the presidents or former presidents, but it is my understanding from people who do know them that, you know, there is kind of a club. And these people have, you know, when you sit behind that big desk, you understand, or, you know, the pressures. And so they do talk and they do share information. Bill Clinton, early in his term, Richard Nixon didn't live very long after he was elected, but did live for about a year and a half or something like that. Clinton stayed in touch with Richard Nixon because Nixon knew so much about foreign policy and he respected him. And Nixon was very happy to provide, you know, whatever counsel he could. So I think it's an interesting dynamic that unfolds that people don't expect, but it really does work. And these, you know, if the president calls, and you're a former president, you still answer the phone.
Well, in Nixon's case, he was the first to identify Bill Clinton as an up-and-coming Democratic star.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And, you know, Nixon, despite whatever weaknesses he may have had, was a really highly skilled politician, and he understood the landscape, and so that he could provide advice to all kinds of people, and he could identify the people who might have the juice, so to speak, to go forward. And certainly Bill Clinton did then, and he still does now.
Yes, the big dog is probably one of the best campaign assets that Obama has.
Absolutely.
So just in closing then, John Geer, you mentioned the idea that these super PACs could pour money in and carpet bomb, particularly for Senate and I assume House candidates as well. In the last minutes, and maybe something you mentioned the case of maybe somebody like an Aiken in Missouri who's in trouble, if there was sufficient money pouring in, that it might be able to reverse the trend. But that sort of flies in the face of the traditional logic about campaigns, and that is the down ticket effect of who's at the top of the ticket, being the president. So are you suggesting that this down-ticket effect is not as great as it was?
I don't think, we call it coattails. I don't think either of these candidates are likely to have a lot of coattails, a little bit maybe. If there's a sudden surge towards, you know, Romney, and a lot of the undecideds might, when they go to vote, if they're voting for Romney, they might just throw, you know, a few more votes the Republicans' way. But there probably won't be big coattails. I mean, these individual races often have a dynamic that separates themselves from the presidential race. But there's some coattails, but again, it's not going to be sizable, I suspect.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Geer.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with John Geer, who's a distinguished professor and chair of political science at Vanderbilt University. His book, In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns, won the 2008 Goldsmith Book Prize from Harvard University. And Professor Geer is currently working on a series of projects that look at the news media's coverage of attack advertising and how negativity may help voters make better choices. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the issue not raised in last night's debate, global warming. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Revkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of the paper's .earth blog, where he's covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asia tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Revkin.
It's good to be with you.
And you also have an article in The New York Times, Obama and Romney, Oil and Science, apropos last night's second presidential debate. A lot of talk about oil, coal, gas, wind, solar. No talk about climate change.
Well, it isn't a surprise, although, as you may have seen, there's been some coverage that Candy Crowley, at the very end, after the debate was over, was chatting about the fact that she almost fit in a question on climate change. So it seemed to be there was someone in the audience who had one to ask. But, you know, that kind of reflects the reality that this is still not even remotely a voting booth issue for Americans. So if you're a politician and you have limited time, and frankly, if you're a CNN host of a debate and you have limited time and you got this long list of issues, the ones that dominate are people's minds or just don't include this. And, you know, whether or not we're facing a future of the powerfully transformed climate, the character of the problem is not the kind of thing that fits well into what we think about when we get into the political arena.
Well, you've written your latest book, Andrew Revkin, is The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. There have been some photographs showing the depletion of the ice caps on the North Pole that are so graphic that you'd think it would have gotten a lot of people's attention. So what explains this lag between the objective information that's out there that the climate is changing, and after all, people in this country have experienced record heat and drought and hurricanes and tornadoes and floods. What's the resistance here to reality?
Well, some of it is a function of what sociologists describe as shifting baselines of perception. In other words, one generation is born with a different sense of normal than the previous generation. On the Arctic, I grew up with the Arctic being a forbidding, froze icy landscape. And when I went there in 2003 to the North Pole in the early spring, you know, there was still the sea ice cloaking the Arctic Ocean was a lot thicker than it is now. But people, kids today, you know, young people born today are born with the norm that the Arctic is a system in flux, that polar bears are a species in peril. That was not the only peril that was facing polar bears when I was a kid was the hunting. Unrestricted hunting. So things change. Perceptions change. Now, on the other front, in terms of extreme weather, polling has shown recently that there is more of a public consciousness that the warming climate is related to extreme weather. But the problem there is the science is very complicated. Tornadoes, for example, the warmer and drier the United States is, the fewer tornadoes we've had. In fact, we've had a tornado drought, if you can imagine such a thing, along with the actual physical climatological drought this summer. So it's not like, you know, the whole climate system is coming unglued. Everything that you see that's abnormal is caused by greenhouse gases. And so that doesn't create a groundswell. You know, even so, scientists can't even honestly say that everything extreme is our fault, which makes it a complex issue. And again, that's something that doesn't end up being front and center. And there, I could go on, but that's a good start.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of the paper's .earth blog, where he's covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. He's the author of Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. Obviously, in terms of pocketbook politics, what came up in the debate last night between President Obama and Mitt Romney was the price of gas. And I guess that's the bottom line in this argument, isn't it? And I guess, are we just simply not mature enough as a political audience to get the understanding that as oil is depleted, it becomes more expensive, and therefore the price of the pump will inevitably go up? So if we made a small investment here, say an extra tax on what gas we have now, that would fast track us to the alternative, so we wouldn't be reliant on this diminishing resource.
Well, you know, I wrote about this today on .earth, and the realities are that Obama tried to pivot in his part of that discussion toward conservation, and he brought up the doubling of mileage standards for vehicles and the need for research. And that's when Romney came in with what I saw as a ridiculous sort of mantra: government doesn't create jobs. Government doesn't create jobs. That was his only response to the line about the need for re-intensifying our research on science frontiers to make us more competitive. And I just think that you're right in terms of the maturity factor. Is not just sort of about our voting behavior, but you know, as a species, yet we're still a young species. We're on a planet where we've just become aware in the last couple of decades, really, that we're becoming a very potent force among the other forces out there that are natural and potent. And we haven't really developed the capacity, I think, yet to shift our short-term behaviors in favor of long-term, modulating long-term risks. It's just not, and this goes even to diet. You know, it's very hard to divert to the apple from the cookie when you're reaching for something. We have that tendency to still to go with our instincts and our first, and that usually draws us to things that are near and things that are now. And climate change, again, is mostly about global scale policy questions, and it doesn't really fit well with the imperative of, you know, having your budget balanced and your car functional now.
Well, of course, the reality of politics is money that undergirds all of politics. And since the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, there's nothing but tons of money flowing in. And in the 2010 election that caught the Democrats by surprise, the biggest single donor to the Republicans in that was the American Petroleum Institute. And they, along with the coal industry, are pouring money into Mitt Romney's coffers. There's a tremendous contest going in some of the swing states that are also coal states, in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and in particular Ohio. There's, you know, lawn signs all over the place that Obama is trying to put you out of work if you're a coal miner. And Romney, of course, is playing that to the hilt. How do we get around the? I mean, do you think this is just going to be taken care of by market factors? The fact that there's so much fracking going on that the price of gas is getting lower and lower, which by the way, the president mentioned, and that's going to make coal less competitive, or in other words, is that going to happen, or is the EPA going to get tough on coal as the conservatives are charging?
Well, I think you're seeing already the shift from coal in pretty rapidly in our mix of energy choices here, and toward gas, and a big chunk of that is certainly driven by the abundance and low price of gas, but some of it's also driven by tightening regulations on power plants, and those have been politically acceptable. There are costs, as George Romney said, including it came up in the debate, I think, this is when he was governor, he talked about the deadly impact of coal pollution, and so there is a broad base of support for, at the very least, cleaning up our coal combustion and certainly becoming more efficient how we use it, and then eventually moving away from it, even leaving it in the ground, heaven forbid, as the other issues like climate develop more of an imperative. And the same thing could happen in China. I wrote about this on Dot Earth. You know, China has a huge amount of natural gas as well. If they get into gear with that, you could see, because of the pollution, the direct pollution impacts, the switch there as well. So these things will be driven by the market. But keep in mind that, you know, what happened with gas is really a function of innovation. There was, whether you love or hate fracking, it's a set of technologies that was ingeniously put together to get gas out of rock that was presumed to be untappable. And that's what we do. When one thing gets scarce, we move to another thing. And that could happen with breakthroughs. If we reinvest at least some money into basic research on energy frontiers relating to non-polluting sources, going beyond gas to renewables or new forms of nuclear, then you could see this happen again and again. But right now we're so disinvested in R&D. One point I made in my piece on Dot Earth was that while Obama brought up the word science and the need for invigorating our research effort here on science frontiers as an underpinning of economic growth, the reality is this country on energy research has been in a slumber party, I call it, for multi-generations, a bipartisan slumber party. That you look at the disinvestment level and you see that Republican or Democratic administrations or Congresses are irrelevant, and that without that changing, without a leader coming forward and saying that this is an imperative, this is the American mission for this century, or at least a big one, then there's a great missed opportunity, and it's not costly either.
Well, obviously it didn't come up in the debate, but you would think that the president would be on firm ground running against the United States Congress, the House in particular, I should say, who have, I think, 8% approval ratings. And in terms, he did mention how much of what he's tried to do has gotten blocked in the House and filibustered in the Senate. But one of the things I find just mind-boggling, if not shameful, is that so many members on the House Science Committee are global warming deniers. You've got Congressman Brown from Georgia, who gave a speech at a church recently about how presumably the dinosaurs were cohabiting with all the other animals on Noah's Ark and that the Earth is 9,000 years old. You've got Sensenbrenner, and of course you've got Todd Akin, who is the man that believes in legitimate rape and a woman's body rejecting unwanted pregnancies. So this is one just can only scratch your head to think the cynicism of putting these people on this committee. But there you have it.
Yeah. Well, that is the real blockade. We have a system set up here where in the Senate, particularly, a very small coalition of from the far right can sort of hold things up. And you need a 60-vote supermajority to get anything meaningful done. And one reason I've shifted away from looking at Washington as the source of solutions here is that that's a reality that's not going away anytime soon.
But when you mentioned fracking earlier and the innovation involved in fracking, of getting extracting gas from shale, obviously the consequences of that aren't well known. The Science Committee, again, they gave the EPA a hard time when they were testifying over what was happening to groundwater in Montana. It seems that this becomes a case of
choosing one's poison. I mean, and what I find particularly disturbing about the defense of coal, and Obama brought up this again, this canard of clean coal, saying how much the U.S. government has invested in it. But what he didn't say is that the coal companies are the ones that promote clean coal as a reality when it's not, and they haven't invested a dime in it. Yet they take credit for something that doesn't exist.
Yeah. It's well, there again, it's hard for me to disagree with you. I've written about it's like fantasy baseball. Clean coal in the context of climate change is truly now just a fantasy, and a pipe dream, as I've called it before.
Well, that leads me to another pipe, and that's the Keystone arguments that came up last night. How did you think? I mean, it's obvious that Romney feels he's on strong ground, talking about the price of gas and the big government getting in the way of private enterprise, and all we need is just to tap what we have in North America, and suddenly we'll have cheap gas again. That is a much more appealing argument, albeit a completely fraudulent one. How did you think fared against Obama's cautious embrace of alternatives?
Well, there again, neither candidate really got into the reality that oil markets are global, and that as long as the price of oil is in the kind of $100 a barrel range, whether we get it from the tar sands of Canada or from equally marginal areas and polluting areas in Nigeria or Venezuela or elsewhere, the demand will be going to the ends of the earth to get this substance. So to me, this is where Obama's statement, which is pretty sophisticated and hard to kind of get through in the noise of a debate about the need for conservation, for cutting demand for oil. If you don't cut demand for oil, and there's just no way you can. The Keystone debate itself, to me, was a distraction, and really, because as I said, you know, it's all about demand. If the price is high enough, we're going to get that oil from somewhere, and that the higher the price, the more marginal the sources. And you know, I think it's actually sort of well, it's hypocritical to say it matters that it's the polluting source in Canada when we're not considering the polluting sources in Nigeria and elsewhere as well.
Well, Andrew Refkin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of the New York Times' .earth blog, where he has covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. His books include Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. He has an article at The New York Times, Obama and Romney, Oil and Science. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.